do it. At Alma here, we are in the middle of a little series on the life of David. David was an Old Testament king, the second king of Israel. And we're looking at what lessons can we learn from this strange, interesting, wonderful, complex, flawed character. What can we learn from his great successes and triumphs? And what can we learn from some of his tragic failures? And so this is the fourth part, I think, of that series. So, Flo, would you like to come forward?
HMS Dreadnought, which seems to have stuck in quite a few minds. I hope you remember what the purpose of that was. But at least I finally feel I've got a sermon title which allows me to lean towards my interest in military history and things like that. At least the title's fairly military. And I actually want to start off with a favourite film of mine, which is Ice Cold in Alex, which those of you who are my age or older might know of. Thank you. And here you can see the cast of British actors. Here they are in Alexandria with their ice-cold beer. I don't think I'm giving anything away from the plot if I tell you this is the end of the film, and they do actually get there and get their ice-cold beer. And interestingly, if you watch the final sequence, you will see that the head on the beer goes up and down quite a few times. It's one of those film things, because they did so many takes. In fact, they did so many takes that John Mills, who's in the foreground here, was properly drunk by the time they'd finished it. Anyway, the American distributors, in the usual way of things, with apologies to Bonnie and Casey and any other visiting Americans, decided the title was a bit too subtle. So they decided to show it in America under the title of Desert Attack, in red capitals. And it would be a bit of a disappointment if you'd gone to watch this film under the basis of that title, because it's actually much more of a drama than a war film. Well, what's all this got to do with our talk, our topic this morning, other than the fact that I just wanted a blatant excuse to try and get your attention before we got into the Bible passages? Well, it's set in a desert. Not much actually happens in the film, a bit like our passage this morning. And perhaps like the American title, the sermon title perhaps promises something which it maybe isn't going to deliver. Hopefully the sermon will deliver something else which is worth thinking about. But since we're not here for a film review, and actually I would give some of the plot elements away if I did that, let's review what we've learnt from the life of David so far, very quickly, which Simon has just briefly covered. So you remember that David has been waiting to become king for many years. He's been anointed by Samuel in chapter 16. He's defeated Goliath in chapter 17. That was actually our first sermon, I think, on facing giants. He then becomes an officer or a general in Saul's army. He meets with quite a lot of success because God is with him. And during this time, he learned patience and trust, and he matured, points that Stuart drew out for us. But he waited on God all during that period. I need to fill in the blanks now between where we were last week when Simon was talking to us about that and where we are today. So Saul becomes quite jealous of David's success, even though David is basically working for Saul, and tries to kill him. In one particular incident, he threw a spear at him 3 times. Saul then tries to snare David into a kind of loveless marriage with one of his daughters, but David doesn't go for that. Saul then tries to get David killed by challenging him to go and kill 100 Philistines. David goes off and kills 200 Philistines. So that doesn't work either. Then he tries to snare him with another daughter who actually loves David, so that doesn't work either. And then, of course, eventually his own son, Jonathan, also becomes a faithful friend of David as well, who intercedes with Saul on David's behalf, promising him that Saul won't actually harm David. At which point, there's another incident where Saul throws a spear at David, and he decides that time is up and perhaps it's time to flee. I think if I'd had the king throwing spears at me on more than one occasion, I would have run off a bit sooner. So with great forbearance, he escapes with the help of Jonathan and Michal, Saul's daughter as well. It's all rather comical, really. Everything that Saul tries to do basically becomes undone. And David spends the next few, I guess, years and chapters in the wilderness. And we're at the start of this incident where Saul is purposefully going about hunting for David. And during this time also, there's quite a lot of, as you'll probably know, there's quite a lot of what you might call a kind of three-cornered fight going on between Saul, on behalf of the Israelites, David, with his gang of men, and the Philistine army as well. So it's a bit like that game of rock, paper, scissors, except every time David turns up, he's always got the thing that defeats the other opponent, whilst the other two are scrapping amongst themselves. Well, that's a quick update on the intervening chapters. Now to our passage. So on this occasion, Saul is hunting David with 3,000 men. David's got 400 or 500 followers at this particular time, and he's hiding in the desert of En-Gedi, where there's a cave. And you can see there's quite a lot of photographs of this. This rock face, cliff face, is quite extensive down the side of the Dead Sea from the Judean Plateau, and it's actually honeycombed with lots and lots of caves. And some of these caves are quite large, and you can hide quite a lot. In fact, you can actually hide a whole army there, which is basically what David did. And you can see on this particular one, it's obviously got some tourists in it, just to give you an idea of the size of the cave there. Actually, my wife's been to these caves, and you can go on tours where people say, this is the cave where David and Saul were hiding. I don't know whether it's got brass plates and all the usual kind of chintz that you get in these kind of things. But anyway, but the whole area is honeycombed with caves. And actually, if you look on the map, this is a kind of general overview looking out over the Dead Sea. Further up up the coast of the Dead Sea, I guess in the cliff faces, is Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. So you can quite understand how some very large jars with scrolls in stayed in caves for 2,000 years, accessible but undiscovered, because there are literally hundreds of these caves, and some of which are quite large and quite deep, and they go on there. Okay, that's rather beside the point anyway for what we're looking at this morning. So if you're wondering how David managed to creep up on Saul and cut his cloak without being heard, of course the things the Bible doesn't describe, and they never show it in a film either. It's kind of like the sound of the kind of grit under your sandals, the squeak of the leather straps on your armour, maybe your armour and the metal clanking together, even the rustle of your clothes. The suggestion is that, I think the passage says, that Saul would have cast his cloak aside and obviously gone off to do what he did. Maybe he also had a sleep as well. I guess the royal chamberlain wasn't going to kind of come rushing into the cave and check that he was all right if he was there for some time. So that would be a bit, you know, his dignity, I guess. So David has this opportunity to cut Saul's cloak, and actually to kill him, of course. And you can kind of imagine the kind of urgent whispers in the back of the cave with David and his men, saying, "Go on, now's your opportunity." To kill Saul, to be done with him. After all, they've been living in the desert for quite a long time. They've been hunted as criminals. But David won't do it, and he's got enough respect and control over his men to stop them from doing that. So he cuts his cloak, and then obviously as Saul goes out, David comes after him. He makes his case to Saul in rather oriental fashion. I think he sort of lays it on with the trowel, but that's the kind of the way you do things in those days. And Saul acknowledges that David has been more righteous than him, and that David will in fact be king. And on the basis of that, he extracts a promise from David that he won't kill his family. Again, something that Simon referred to last week as well. So the question is, what can we learn from this incident, and indeed this period in David's life? Because I suspect the most obvious application, that you shouldn't go killing your master or your king, isn't terribly relevant to most of us in the 21st century in a democracy. So I'm going to suggest a number of things that we can learn from David, generally, from this, and how we should treat our enemies. And just to help you, they're all going to start with the letter P. I kind of realised I'd missed a bit of a trick because I should have put Psalms in as well, which of course starts with letter P, but doesn't sound like it. Anyway, so firstly, patience. David had to wait for the fulfilment of God's promise that he was going to become king. Saul didn't look like he was going to give up the kingship anytime soon, and so David had to really exercise that patience, which actually is a form of grace if you think about it. And of course, patience, I think, has featured quite heavily in quite a lot of sermons, so I won't say too much about it, but it is, of course, a fruit of the Spirit. As Galatians 5 says, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience. Actually, the NIV also has down forbearance, which I think is quite a good translation of that. Kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. So David had to withhold his hand, not to seize the kingship by force, because obviously that wasn't the way to win people over, as well as it not being in God's plan. And we often sing, actually, strength will rise as we wait upon the Lord, which is a chorus, which I got my daughter Rachel to research last night because I couldn't find the reference. It's actually Psalm 27, verse 14, a psalm, of course, written by David. And his strength, I would suggest, rose as he waited patiently. If I referenced all the psalms, which would be relevant to this passage, we'll be here to the end of the day, so I won't do that. But patience or forbearance is perhaps a bit passive. Perhaps we need something a bit more, we need an active patience, if you can have such a thing. So I'm going to suggest that something else that David did was persevere. Again, lots of passages one could choose, but James says in his letter, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, which David was, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Well, we'll pass over the consider it pure joy on this particular occasion and just concentrate on the perseverance. And this, of course, is exactly what David needed to do. He had to be tested in his faith. He was growing in leadership of men. He was living as an outcast in the desert. If you think about it, he had a growing band of men who were coming to him, which meant he had more people to feed and to hide, to keep order, and they were looking to him for leadership as well. So there's no passive patience on his part. You remember, he killed Goliath 2 weeks ago, we were reading. He was the youngest of eight brothers. He was a shepherd boy at that time. He had a lot to learn. So he learnt wisdom and he grew in faith, qualities that he was going to need to draw upon when he was king, when he was exercising leadership over the whole nation of Israel, which grew to its greatest extent under his kingship. And I wonder how many psalms he wrote whilst he was an outcast in a cave, either in this period or actually later on when he was being challenged by one of his own sons. I don't know whether you've thought about this, and it only struck me whilst I was preparing this, that actually the fruit of David's trials and perseverance on these occasions was that he has given comfort to and he has ministered to millions, if not tens or hundreds of millions of Christians and other people over the intervening 3,000 years. That's quite an impressive ministry through, of course, the Psalms that he wrote. Because of the trials he went through and the period that he was basically being tested in the wilderness, which should, of course, put you in mind of Jesus as well. But David also had to persevere in maintaining his own ethical standards as well, his principles with this rather rough band of men that he's got with him, with Saul constantly hunting him and not knowing who he could trust, who would betray him, living in caves, constantly hungry and thirsty. It would have been easy for David to have turned and fought Saul, to take matters into his own hands. His men were encouraging him to do that. As they say in the detective programs, he had motive, opportunity, and means. Actually, he had quite a big motive, because not only was he going to become king, but actually that was God's will for him to become king. So he could have taken that. He had opportunity. Saul has walked into the cave, basically at his most vulnerable point. And, of course, we know he had a knife, so he had means as well. But of course, if you adopt the tactics of the enemy, you become like the enemy. Or if you like, the ends don't justify the means. How we live with God, I think, is more important than what we achieve. And in fact, David's principles do nearly slip, actually. When he cuts Saul's cloak, that is actually an assault upon the king. although not physically, and this is why he's conscience-stricken straight afterwards, and why he rebukes his men so fiercely, because he realises he's made a mistake. The robes were the kind of symbol of kingly office, and in fact they're going to feature in a chorus we'll sing after this, and think about that whilst we're singing that, about what that says about how God values us in terms of that. But aside from restraining his own men and not fighting, he could also have fled. He could have taken the easy option. He could have become a general in a neighbouring country, perhaps. But that would have undone God's work as well. He could have had a life after a fashion. It would have been fine. But no, he had to work it. He had to persevere and stick with those principles. I'm pleased to say I haven't had a lot of enemies. But as some of you know, and I have talked about it before, I was in quite a difficult situation in my business in 2016. And actually for me, it would have been quite easy just to give up and walk away from that, which I was pretty tempted to do. There was a quote in my weekly newspaper this week that said, "One of the most time-consuming things is to have an enemy." And I can certainly agree with that. It saps all your mental and emotional strength and energy, and then it starts to affect your health as well, and of course your other relationships. And actually pretty much the only reason I didn't give up at that time was on the basis of principles for the sake of other people. And I found out afterwards that this person who was causing a lot of problem, if he'd had his way, he would have sacked half the company. So I'm glad I stuck in there from that point of view. I won't be writing any psalms as a result of that, you'll be pleased to hear. But I understand a lot better now what David wrote, and obviously that's why psalms speak so much to people who are in difficult situations, whether it's persecution or other situations they find themselves in. So lastly, I'd like to suggest or notice that an opponent or an enemy is not a thing or an abstract object. They are still a person. They're probably a hurting, damaged, insecure, frightened person, but still a person made in the image of God, needing redemption, salvation, love and grace as much as any of the rest of us. Quite possibly with less insight and less opportunity to hear and respond to the gospel. To return to my film briefly, if I might, Al. This film, without giving the plot away, has quite a lot to say about how you treat an enemy, and I can't say too much about it. But you won't be surprised to hear that at least one character dies. They have a burial, and the sergeant recites Psalm 23 over the grave, David's most famous psalm. You'll know it well. And just think about this sort of desert scene and the words of Psalm 23 as I read them out. "The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil. For you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." Of course, in the film, there's a very filmic scene where actually the enemy tanks roll into the scene, precisely on verse 5, which is, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies." I must finish with the obvious words, really, from Jesus in Matthew's Gospel. "You have heard that it was said, 'Love your neighbour and hate your enemy,' but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that?" Of course, that's all a lot easier said than done. And I'm assuming for most of us, we're talking about relatively normal situations, but let's bear in mind, and actually the Barnabas Fund collection is a good thing to consider, there are many Christians in the world today who have enemies who are actually trying to harm, kill and persecute them, actually doing it quite actively. But we'll try and keep things relevant for ourselves. So I suspect for some of these things that actually where we have enemies or opponents that actually a lack of communication or understanding may be an issue. And actually, if you can establish a relationship with someone, then that may go some way towards resolving differences, which is probably the last thing you want to do with someone you feel is opposing you or is making life very difficult. Most people, I think, are reasonable when you get to know them. It's the kind of unknown that's frightening. So maybe trying to build bridges with someone that you're finding difficult. Show them kindness. We've had from Alma Go random acts of kindness. I'd like to suggest in this particular case we'd have targeted acts of kindness. And if that doesn't work, of course, we're still encouraged to turn the other cheek, to go the extra mile. It causes people to think. Shows that we have different principles and different values. And if they take advantage of us, well, we've still followed and still obeyed Jesus first and foremost. So hopefully you agree that counterattacking is not the right answer, despite the sermon's title. David was patient. He persevered in a very difficult place for quite a long time and learned a lot through the process. He didn't compromise on his principles. He held on to the promise that God had for him. He treated Saul as a person, and he constantly tried to restore relationship with Saul, actually. In fact, the Bible records the fact that David was the only person in the Bible who is recorded as having mourned for Saul, and he wrote a psalm or lament, which is recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 1. So he didn't respond with violence or anger. He didn't capitulate and give in either, not because of injustice in his own case, but because actually it was part of God's plan for him. So I suggest the best response that we can have if we do feel that we have an enemy or an opponent is to keep our focus on God's promises, to live out the principles that God has given us in the plan that we understand that he has for us.
Jonathan. In order to respond to that, there's so many ways you could respond to that, isn't there? Prayer is the obvious one, and that's what we're going to do, but also those relationships, conversations, all sorts of different things, seeking help and advice. If you're in a similar sort of situation to the one Jonathan has described this morning, or the ones, but what I'd like to do is respond in prayer, and to use the words of that psalm that Jonathan, there's too many Jonathans and Davids, aren't there, that Jonathan shared this morning, to use that as a basis for our response to God. And one of the things I love about this psalm particularly is that in so many situations in life, I've said or read this psalm and thought, wow, this applies to this situation right now. It's such a rich psalm. So I'm going to take time to read it. And give space for you. If a line leaps out at you, make that your prayer. Use that and say, God, this is my prayer this morning. So let's pray. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And I shall dwell in the house of the Lord my whole life long. Amen. Amen. And I recognize that a talk